My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I haven't found it necessary to have a drink since January 25th, 1981. I got to think about that. My memory's not that good. You know that diminished capacity thing. And I'm a member of the South Dixie group, and it's good to be here. I was thinking just the other day. I all my AA life, I've been sober. I guess it's a little over 38 years, and without the drink. Unfortunately, the alcoholism sort of hangs on there. So I suffered from that. I suffer from that alcoholism thing. It's not so bad anymore. Used to be pretty bad. And for years, I don't know how long, 15, 20 years, you know, I had that thing. My sponsor used to call it, he used to talk about equanimity. I think I brought that up last time I was here. I brought that up. And he would, I've had four sponsors. I have, because they're all temporary, you know, they like die on you. And it gets a little harder, you know, when you get around 38 years and somebody, my last sponsor, he had 55 years, he like died on me. And so selfish. And alcoholics, you can't trust any of them. You can't depend on them, you know. And what a wonderful man. All my sponsors were incredible. I'll never be as good a sponsor as my sponsors were. So after he dies, you know, a guy with 55 years, and I'm 70 years old, and I got to find the guy. And I mean, I don't know what this is, AA. I don't know what this is, some AA truth or not, but you look for somebody that's older down the road from you, who's been around longer, and you can learn from that you want what they have. And I finally located. I knew that there was somebody I wanted to locate, but there was somebody I knew. You know, the Lord always puts people in your life that you sort of know they're there. Whenever any of my sponsors died, there was always somebody there. And there was this guy there, and, you know, I knew I should get a sponsor. I mean, I knew. You see, I know. You can't do this stuff. You can't be 38 years sober and talking and doing this crap and then walk around without a sponsor saying, well, I don't really need one. You can't do that. Even though you, but, you know, there's this void. I still suffer from alcoholism. I'm still an alcoholic. And, you know, it says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, his sobriety will be precarious, and if true happiness will find none at all. And one of the consequences of being an alcoholic is you bullshit yourself a lot. You know, a lot of self-deception, selfishness, self-centeredness, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion. You delude yourself a lot, and one of the delusions we have is the old Roland Hazard delusion. Now, knowing the inner workings of my mind, drinking is impossible, I'll be okay. Nevertheless, he was drunk in 2 weeks. So that's why people get drunk after Alcoholics Anonymous, because they never do the real deal. They never get to the deal we're going to talk about today. What they do is they do the superficial AA, where they get to the point where they learn a lot, they know a lot, they're intelligent, because God knows we're all brilliant. But what happens is somewhere along the line, after they learn everything they need to learn about AA, and they've gone through the 3 years or 5 years or 20 years of AA, they start doing the Roland Hazard thing. Now knowing the inner workings of my mind, I ain't going to drink, I'm okay, I'm feeling good, I have a couple bucks in my pocket, and I don't need to go to 7 meetings a week, I don't need to do what that Russell guy does, these guys are flipping fanatic, you know, I mean, I can go to 3 meetings a week, and next thing you know, you got an excuse because you got to go here, and you got kids, you go to 2 meetings, and next it's 1 meeting a week, and then it's 1 meeting every 2 weeks, and then you sort of stop going to meetings because you're doing other things, and then 3 years later, you're back at a meeting picking up a white check, and somebody asks you, why after 10 years did you drink? He says, I stopped going to meetings. And you stop going to meetings not because you intend to drink, because you know you're not going to drink. You're like Roland Hazard. There's a reason why this stuff is in the book, you know? There's a reason why this stuff is in the book, and as you get older and older in AA, you have more and more time. You look at things that you read when you had 2 years or 5 years, or, you know, 10 years. You sort of look at it from a different angle, like a diamond. You look at it. You look at it. So I look at it from a different angle. You know. I you know, there are different ways of looking at that Roland Hazard story. So I look at it as to because you know you're always sort of thinking, why do people drink? You know, maybe if I could figure that out, I won't drink. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that. So in any event, so my sponsor used to talk about equanimity. A lot. There's different ways of saying equanimity. It's in the Bible and all over the place. But one of the things he used to say, I remember one time, I'll give the short story. This is a, you know, all my stories, I could do an hour on each one of my stories. I'll do the 5-minute version. Some of you have heard this. When I was about 9 years sober, I called my sponsor, and And I did this thing by the numbers. I mean, I really did. I mean, I'm not a perfect AA. I didn't do this thing perfectly. But all in all, I pretty much did this thing by the numbers. I came in on my knees. As a matter of fact, I on December 25th, 1981, it got so bad for me that I got down on my knees. I turned on the TV, said it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Some preacher said, you want to change your life, give your life to Jesus. I got down on my knees. I said the sinner's prayer, gave my life to Christ, and which is a pretty big deal for a Jewish kid from New York, and which sort of indicates to you, if you have any idea of what that is all about, how desperate I was. And then afterwards, you know, I did the deal. In other words, I got a sponsor. I connected with a sponsor. All my sponsors I've always been close to. I've always spent time with. I have people say, will you sponsor me? And I'll say, sure. You know, and I hear from them once or twice, and then I stop hearing from them. And then there are other guys that hang around. But I always hung around with my sponsors. I was always close to them. I mean, real close, almost every day, and I'd follow them around. And I always went to step meetings to follow different people because I always wanted, I was hungry. I was always hungry. I always knew that there was more, something I hadn't got. So I would go to step meetings. I would follow guys around, like Joe Snyder, like Ray O'Keefe. I would follow him around to go to different step meetings because maybe this guy will give me the answer or something. I was always hungry. I read the big book. I studied the stuff, you know, the literature. You know, I sponsored people. I took on service, even though I thought, you know, when I first started, I rarely, if ever, took on service where my sponsor didn't say, you need to do this. I mean, believe me, I was not in here for extra credit, in a sense. You know what I mean? It's not like I say, gee, I think I'll do the bar. My sponsor would say, you need to start doing the bar. You need to be the secretary of the group. You need to do the intergroup banquet. I was in the group banquet for 2 hours. I mean, I did all the things that was suggested of me. I mean, sometimes I balked, and sometimes I screwed around and with the force. I did everything like we all do, sort of screwed. But essentially, eventually, I did the whole deal. You know, I got down on the knees. I said the third step prayer. I did that deal. You know what I mean? And I used to think that was a big deal. It's not such a big deal. I'm going to talk about that a little bit in this deal, you know. And so I did that stuff. And I think my sobriety was good sobriety. I think it was good. You know, as good as it is, you know. I mean, I didn't drink. That's pretty good, you know. But I think I had times over 10 or 15 years, 20 years, or many times where I was at peace with myself. And I think there were many, many times in my sobriety that I was grateful. I went to many, many meetings where I just had a wonderful time that I enjoyed. I meant, you know, but you know how this disease is. And, you know, I mean, maybe you don't, but I think you do. One of the things I've learned here is one of the old ideas is that nobody could understand me. I'm so different. I don't even understand me. I'm so different. So all I've been doing is trying to be as they say, the only thing you need to do in order to have good AA meeting is be sincere. And once you learn how to fake that, you got it made. And so what I just try to do is just talk about what my actual experience was, unfiltered. And that seems to work. People come up to me and say, hey, you're talking about me. So my experience is I loved sobriety. I loved AA. I was always looking for more. I was always hungry. I was always thirsty. You know, I mean, when I first came in, I was looking for the balance. You know, how do I find balance? I don't want to be a crazy person about AA, but my idea of balance, by the way, is going to a bar at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when you have a wife and kid at home and coming out at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's how I do balance, you know, when I was drinking. It was for me to spend 12 hours drinking a bar was easy, you know what I mean? So I'm the last guy to talk about balance. You know, one time I said to my sponsor, my first sponsor, I was trying to figure out how to do AA without getting too fanatical about it. So after I was about a month sober, I somehow figured out that I didn't have to go to meetings on Thursdays. And I told my first sponsor, Bob Sullivan, I said, I don't think I have to go to meetings on Thursday. He says, oh, yeah, as long as you never drank on Thursday. I said, oh, yeah. And then he said to me, he said, you know, Russ, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. I had graduated with the Department of Honors in Mathematics. I was going for my PhD in algebraic topology. I was division chief in the state attorney's office. I tried about 30 murder cases, 20 murder cases, before I was like 30 years old. And, you know, I was a National Science Foundation fellow. And I can promise you, I never in my entire life heard anybody, nobody ever said to me, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father. I had never, not only had that never been said to me, I had never even heard that said to anybody else. And at a month sober, I came in here, I wasn't doing too well. I had two neurons working, they were waving goodbye to each other, and wasn't doing too good. And when he said, you know as much about life as a dog knows about his father, I sat there trying to figure out what he was trying to explain to me. And you don't make this stuff up, I'm just telling you the truth. And because I didn't understand what he was saying. I really didn't. You guys are obviously very sharp, you understand. And, so I pictured a dog and a doggy family, like a doggy daddy, doggy mom, and little doggy puppies. As a matter of fact, I had the exact dog in mind, the RCA Victor dog that was, you know, with a patch, you know. And somewhere along the line, I figured out, wait a second, dog doesn't know his father, you know? I mean, I figured that out. I thought maybe he was telling me I was brilliant or something. And that's the guy who told me when I said, these are my degrees on my wall in my law office. I said, these are my degrees, Bob. He said, well, you know, Russ, rectal thermometers have degrees. You know what they do with those. Oh, yeah, very good, Janine. Janine just got it, you know? You know, what happens when the meds kick in, it's hard to remember. Now you got me off that. So 9 years sober, I told my sponsor, Joe Snyder, I had a fight with my wife because she was, you know how she is, and you remember she's a member of Al-Anon, you know, I've been married to her for 38 years, member of Al-Anon, and you know, I just got a phone with her. I'm driving here, she tells me, she calls me up, she says, why is this person a friend of yours on Facebook? And the only thing I said, I don't have time for this. I don't know what to say. I don't have, you know, with Al-Anon, when I'm wrong, she promptly admits it. And Al-Anon tends to. This is what I deal with. You know, I got to tell her, why am I friends with this person on Facebook? And, in any event, the fact of the matter, so I told my sponsor, we had this big argument, and I told my sponsor I was going to divorce my wife, and I gave him detail as to everything she had done. It was like horrendous stuff. Like she had dissed me or treated me bad or treated me with disrespect, and you know, this marriage is over. I didn't sign up for this crap, and blah 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 blah. And he said to me, you know why? He said, you know. And after I was done explaining to him everything, and if there's one thing alcoholics know, they know why they're upset. You know, and I knew why I was upset. I told him point blank what the story is. I said, this marriage is over. He says, do you know why you're upset? Because, you know, I've always been sponsored by people that aren't as smart as me. So, I mean, he asked me a stupid question, you know. Sponsors ask stupid questions. He says, do you know why you're upset? I said, of course I know why I'm upset. I just explained it to him. He says, that's not why you're upset. I said, what are you talking about? He says, that's not why I'm upset. I said, everything I just told you, what she did, that's not why. Nah, that's not why you're upset. That's not why you're upset. So he says, no, that's not why you're upset. Oh, he shut up. And I said, well, you know why I'm upset? He said, yeah, I know why you're upset. Absolutely. I said, you know why I'm upset? Yeah, absolutely. I know why you're upset. 9 years sober, you're an alcoholic. I know why you're upset. I said, oh, well, you're going to tell me why I'm upset? He said, you really want to know? I said, well, of course I want to know. And he said exactly these words. He said, listen, stupid. From my first sponsor to my last sponsor, they are fond of calling me stupid. I don't know what that's all about. He said, you know, dog knows about his father, whatever, it's the same thing. He said, listen, stupid. He said, you're upset because you're upsettable. It's like Zen AA or something, you know. So many moving pieces in this world, so many things to get upset about, so many worldly glamours, so many things I don't have, so many things I have that I'm worried about. So many things I want to have. So many problems. So many assholes. So many people get in your way. So many times that people act, you know, bad. I mean, this world, it's really pretty crappy, isn't it? I mean, you know, listen, if you're upsettable, listen, you're just, believe me, I could get upset. I didn't need to be out there to get resentments. I could get resentments in here, you know. It's just people, you know. It just drive me crazy, you know, and upsettable. And that's what he said to me. But what Joe's in. Later on, what Joe explained to me about equanimity is he said, equanimity is the capacity to be at peace with yourself and serene and have serenity even when all hell is breaking out around you. As a matter of fact, even better than that, it's the ability to be at peace when outside circumstances are attacking you. And the one thing I could say about my alcoholism who I am and what I am and how I feel and how I behave is connected to everything that's going on around me. I am very, as I said to my sponsor, I used to say, well, I'm sensitive. He says, no, great artist is sensitive. You're just touchy. I am very aware of how you look at me, how you talk to me, what's happening around me, how much money I have in the bank, what bills are coming. I am very aware of every circumstance around me that has to do with me. I'm aware of shit that's going on in Bangladesh that I don't like. You know what I mean? I'm very aware of the stupid world and the stupid people and everything around me. And that's just some sort of, I don't even think of it as a problem. It's just the way I am. You know? And when you are very, very sensitive, you tend to, and somehow, I don't know what, this has something to do with my alcoholism, the consequences. I actually think that everything has to do with me. Everything sort of threatens me or bothers me or something like that. And so I'm restless and I'm irritable and discontent. And I say things like, well, if it happened to you, you'd be that way too. Well, if it happened to you, you'd react that way too. And I'd meet people in AA and shit was happening to them and they weren't reacting. And they didn't even look bad or feel bad. And I said, how do you do that shit? How do you do that crap, you know? They were always like in their 70s and had 40 years sobriety and everything like that. And that kind of thing. But I didn't know how they did it. I figured they were wealthy, never had any problems. Some of these guys were dying of cancer, and, you know, they were fine, you know, and they had no problem. Not like me, you know. I mean, a slight wind blows, and I go nuts, you know. And, you know, anything happens that I don't like, you know, it's a problem. And so that's an example of equanimity. I like the way the Apostle Paul talks about it in the book of Philippians, and which I started studying later on in sobriety when I wanted more. And the way he puts it, he says, I've learned the secret. He calls it the secret. I've learned to be content in all things. You know, I've been rich and I've been poor, and I've had homes and I've been without a home. And I've been, he says, I've just learned to be content. I think I can do all things. I have the strength to do all things through focusing on God. Or I like the way the book talks about it all the time. It says the same thing. It says, once we make this decision, a sincere decision for God, all sorts of remarkable things happen. He says we will be given everything we need if we stay close to him and perform his work well. It also says in the book, you know, nothing in the book, you know, I used to think that these guys like Bill Wilson invented it until I read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers when I was about 10 or 15 years sober and started studying that. And you know, that was, the big book was written in 1939 and A started in 1935. So as you know, in the big book it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly, you know, they throw words in like utterly, thoroughly, thoroughly followed our path. And that was written in 1939, and somewhere around 9 or 10 years sober, when I was sober and I was, you know, doing okay, the way people at 9 years do okay. You know, it was great sobriety, except for when it wasn't good. You know how sobriety is. Sobriety is great until something happens that upsets you, right? I mean, you know, 3 years sobriety was great until the IRS took money out of my account. You know, 3 years sobriety, 5 years sobriety was great until, you know, something happened. You know what I mean? And I woke up at 3 o'clock in the morning saying, what am I going to do about this? You know, sobriety is great unless you don't get your own way. You know, unless something happens to screw up your plans. And then it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you got 10,000 thoughts, all bad thoughts about yourself and other people. The fear, there's nothing worse than sober fear. Mm-hmm. Nothing worse than sober fear. Nothing worse than that fear that you know they're all going to find out what an asshole you are. They're all going to find out how phony you are. You're going to lose that car. You're going to lose that house. You're going to lose that wife. You're going to lose. As a matter of fact, you're a frickin' loser. You might as well kill yourself. You don't want to drink, but suicide is looking like a possible option. There's nothing worse than sober, you know, and going through that deal, you know. And actually, what you don't even realize as you're going through it, as bad as it is that's the key to getting closer to God. Because when things are going good, you can give a shit, you know. You're in control and you're in power. When things start going bad, and that's how they talk about it, that's what they said in the book of James, rejoice when you have when you have trials of many kinds, because when you rejoice in your trials and you look to God, he said, what will happen is your faith will grow, and you'll have faith that works. That's what it says in the 12 and 12, in the 12 and 12, where it says, the way we get a new perspective on this whole deal in the seventh step is unbelievably painful, only by repeated humiliations and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency, you know, do we grow in this deal, and do we get a new perspective? That's why you're all here. Not because you were riding the crest and said, oh, man, I got $1 million in the bank. I'm getting laid every day. I think I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous. This would be a good time to go there. You know what I mean? Well, no, you came here on the balls of your ass because you were scared, and this is the last place you wanted to come. And all of a sudden you got well, and you said, well, maybe I'm over fucking reacting. You know what I mean? Things aren't so bad, you know, and that kind of deal. So in any event, so that's how, so then finally, I don't know how long it's going to take you. We all have our different deals. I don't want you to assume that I'm saying this is, you know, somewhere around 25 years, things started settling down real good. And, you know, it's not that I didn't experience the promises. You know, I'd experience, you know, I remember when I was about 8 years sober and I had lost all my credit cards, and because apparently if you spend more money than you make, you go into debt. And I didn't know that. You know, I was a math major. But, you know, I was just spending money I don't have, buying shit I don't need to impress people I didn't like, you know, because I wanted people to think more of me. Because somehow if you're an alcoholic, you worry about what other people think about you, while at the same time you're telling yourself you don't give a shit what other people think about you. And what happens, but your lifestyle betrays you because you act and you talk like you're worried about what they think about you and that kind of stuff, you know. When you lose that fear of people and of economic insecurity, when that actually goes away, you can talk faster at AA meetings. You know, that's what that means. You don't have to run through the filter of what do they think about me if I say this or say that, you know. You can relax, you know, and be yourself, which is something I could never be. I always wanted to be whatever you thought I should be in order for you to like me. And because if you're an alcoholic, one of the things about alcoholism, as opposed to the drinking, which is really just a symptom of the disease, not the disease, but one of the consequences of the disease is it's very important for you to try to figure out what you need to do so people will accept you and like you. Because if you're an alcoholic, you're a please love me-aholic, and you know, you get really upset if you think people don't like you. Has to do, I suppose, with being sensitive or something, and you overreact and do a lot of things. But in any event, so I would experience. I remember I went up to Ray O'Keefe once. I was broke again. I had this ability, like a lot of alcoholics have, to make a lot of money, and I had ability to spend twice as much as I make. So, you know, and I said to him, I said, when am I going to have financial security? Because the book promises that we're all going to be millionaires, apparently. It says, did you know that? The book says that. It says we're all going to be millionaires, we'll never have financial insecurity. And I said, when am I going to, he said to me, what? He had about 35 years. He said, what are you talking about? He says, the promises. He says, I've been working on this thing. I'm like 8 years. I've done all the stuff and everything. I figured by now I'd be a multimillionaire. You know, I'd be in Trump Towers or whatever the hell it is. And he said, what are you talking about? He says, the book. He says, the promise. He says, it doesn't say that. I said, I just read it. It says it. He says, read it to me. And I opened it up. And I said, fear of people and financial insecurity will leave you. He says, yes, Russell, the fear will leave you. He says, you will always be broke. It just won't bother you. You know what I mean? And he was right. He was right, you know? If it doesn't bother you. I used to tell my sponsor, a guy wants to check on me, and I would be all mad and crazy. And he'd say to me, I'd say, what am I going to do? And he'd say, well, let me ask you something. How would you feel if it didn't bother you? I'd say, what the fuck are you talking about? Say, how would you feel? Sometimes you got to use the F word because that's the only thing that means it. Because I speak alky in my brain. That's what I say. What the fuck? He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? I said, I don't understand the question. He says, how would you feel if it didn't bother you? How would I feel if it didn't bother me that he bounced a check on me? Yeah, how would you feel? How would I feel if it didn't bother me that he bounced a check on me? Is that what you're asking? He says, yeah. How would it feel right now if it didn't bother you that he bounced a check on me? He says, well, if it didn't bother me, I'd feel fine. He said, what the fuck? What the hell? How do you get that? You know what that is, by the way? That's equanimity. That's I've learned to be content in all things. That's something that alcoholics... You know, I would experience the promises, you know, for... for like a couple of hours. You don't have fear of financial insecurity for a couple of hours. And you, when you start experiencing the promises, it's usually when you've turned over things in your life to God and you're closer to Him. And even though shit is happening to you, after you've gone through a horrible amount of sleepless nights and all sorts of worry and fear, and you don't know what's going to happen to you, at some point in time, you do what's called turn it over. And you turn it over to God, and you say, well, you know, this is, you finally figure out, I've worried about this thing for 3 weeks. I know my life is over. I don't know what's going to happen, but you want to know something? I think finally, based upon 10,000 times I've said the Serenity Prayer, I think this is probably one of those things that I cannot change. I finally figured that out. So you know something? I'm just going to turn it over to God. And then all of a sudden, you're not worried about it. Somebody said, well, what about that problem with the cancer? I said, I've turned it over. Man, I wish I had done it 3 weeks ago and had to go through this thing. But you know, when you're new and when you got 5 years, it takes you know, more and more, less and less time as you go along to turn it over and turn it over. And so I kept on going, getting closer and closer and doing more and more things like the 11th step says, because I couldn't, because a fuzzy God didn't work for me. You know, the fuzzy God, you know, fuzzy God worked, you know, because it's a spiritual kindergarten. It worked at first, the fuzzy God, but you know, it didn't really work for me. I had to get more and more closer and closer, more and more. And so around 9 years sober, I started going to church because our big book encourages church membership, you know. And, you know, I read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, trying to do this thing thoroughly. And, you know, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, because for the first 4 years, they weren't reading the big book. It wasn't around, so I wanted to see what they were doing, and Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers talks about what they were doing. It says the books that we find absolutely essential, 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, and the book of James. So I started studying those books because that's what they were doing when they read the big book. And I didn't really realize the big book came from the Bible and it's all in there and everything. Like, as a matter of fact, when I started studying the Bible, I started going to Bible study, and they were studying the Bible. I said, holy shit, this Bible thing, they're getting everything from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's amazing, this shit you learn, you know. And but as I got closer and closer, more and more, and one of the things I realized about the consequence of being an alcoholic is something I heard in a non-AA setting. A gentleman was talking, he said, the person you'll be in the next 5 years depends upon the people you hang out with and the books you read. And the books you read really depend upon who you hang out with. And you know, when I was hanging around the guys that were talking about women, and that's who I hung around all the time, the guys in the bars that were talking about women getting laid and all that stuff, you know what I thought about all the time? Never made me feel good. And when I was hanging around guys that were talking about money and cars and things, you know what I used to think about all the time? Money, cars, and things. You wanna know something? Never made me feel good. Always made me feel bad. Could never understand why it made me feel bad. And when I started hanging around with AA people who believed in God and church people, because I can tell you one thing, you could put down church, there's a lot of denominations, I found one that I love, church people. I can tell you one thing, all they talk about in church is God. It's unbelievable. You know, I started going to Bible study. It's unbelievable. They hold up a picture of a squirrel. They say, what is this? And I'm thinking, I know it's a squirrel, but I know the answer is Jesus. You know what I mean? These people are nuts because everything's Jesus. You know what I mean? But you know what happened? You know what happened? Calm down, Janine. It's embarrassing. So you know what happened? What happened to me is the more I hung around these people, the more I started thinking about God. So I'm thinking about God and talking about God in AA, and I'm thinking about and talking about God outside AA, and I'm driving my car and I'm listening to hymns, and I'm thinking about God, and I have lunch with about 5 guys in AA that I sponsor, and I'm going to go have lunch right after this, and we're going to talk about God. And what happens is, and what I notice is, the more I talk about God, the more I focused on God, and the more I focused on God, the less I focused on women and sex and money and all the shit that used to drive me nuts. And somewhere along the line, I guess I think I got that equanimity thing. I think that's what happened. And the answer was God. And it was always right in front of me, because in the big book it says, if you want to be rocked in the fourth dimension of existence and experience much of heaven, it said the great fact is this and nothing less. It says your whole thinking has to be revolutionized. It's like Dr. Jung says to Roland Hazard, he said, ideas, emotions, and attitudes that are the driving forces, guiding forces of these men's lives, have to be shifted one side, and they become dominated by a whole new set of ideas, emotions, and attitudes. That's what it says, and it says our real problem is selfishness and self-centeredness. We must get rid of the selfishness or it kills us. God makes that possible. Why didn't I see this? Why didn't I get this deal? And then it says in the big book, it says the great fact is this and nothing less. Nothing less than this is our creator becomes the central fact of our lives. we're absolutely certain that he lives in our hearts and minds and in a way which is indeed miraculous. He is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. Why didn't I see this? Why didn't I see this? That it was all about God, that the whole big book was about getting me to develop a relationship, a real relationship with God that works, you know, and then improve upon that always, always, always. Why didn't I see it? Why did I settle for just mere physical sobriety? I know a lot of people do that. I used to think the third step was the big deal, you know, but then I realized the third step isn't really a big deal at all. You know, there's a lot of people, now don't get me wrong, there's a lot of people that don't do the third step at all. They'll believe they decide not to do it and they get whatever they get. But when you think about it, the third step is really just getting, I did the third step, I got down on my, hey, I did the third step, I wanted to be part of the club, I wanted what they had, I was hungry, I got down on my knees, I said the third step prayer, you know what I mean? Ain't no big deal. I locked the door, I was in my house, I didn't want anybody wandering off in the street, seeing me down on my knees, I was a little embarrassed about the thing, you know what I mean? I did the third step deal, it took me 5 seconds, I got up and I did whatever the fuck I wanted to do. I lived my life the way I wanted to live it. God was not a part of my life. You know, they talk about that in the seventh step. They say you can even have a belief in God, a superficial belief in God. Somebody says, you believe in God? Oh, yeah, I believe. You believe in God? Oh, yeah, I have a higher power. You believe in God? Oh, yeah, I call him good orderly direction, whatever the hell that is, even though the chapter agnostic says that the mere code of moral, so our better philosophy of life would have helped us, we'd be sober a long time ago, but we needed a power that didn't help us. But some people still do the mere code of morals, a better philosophy, because they want to sort of like, it's sort of like a phony God, you know, and it's a way of saying you believe in God, but you don't really believe in God. You just believe in doing the next right thing, which is okay for the first couple of months or something. But the big book says that means you wrote a book where we talk about God, and that's when the piss alcoholics off. He either is or he isn't. We're talking about a divinity. What's it going to be? Give your life to the Creator. And people do all sorts of things in AA, even if they get down on their knees and say third step, just to avoid the God thing, you know, because they really do want to have control of this deal. But there are consequences to not doing this thing thoroughly. There are consequences to, you know, the consequences are our anxiety and agony and not getting the full power of the steps and the change and the promises, you know. And so to me, I ultimately learned that in my life, the real deal is when you get to 6 and 7, when you entirely give your whole life to God. You give it all. You give the whole deal. You may not get perfect, but you want to do it. And you humbly get on your knees and say, you know, God help me, God help me, please help me in everything, you know, and you're doing the stuff, you're doing the deal, which is probably why they say this is the step that separates the men from the boys. AA, a lot of boys, a lot of people would like bullshit sobriety. I mean, I don't want to say sobriety is bullshit. I think it's great that there's a ton of people and a great fellowship where people aren't drinking, we're patting stuff on the back, we're having toga parties and shit like that, and conventions. I think it's wonderful, it's great, you know. But you know, I really wanted that. I wanted that thing my sponsor had, that equanimity thing. So, one of the things that happens to get to it, because somebody might be wondering why isn't he talking about the fifth step, which I'm going to talk about now. One of the things the big book says that was all leading up to what I'm going to say right now. One of the things that the big book says, it says our stories. Anybody ever hear this? Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened. You know, when I first heard that, and quite frankly, even up until a month ago, what I thought that referred to is our stories. Our stories. What do we got, like 60 people in the room or something, whatever it is? 60 different stories. And it can refer to that. It probably does refer to that. But now I look at it a little bit differently. And I'll tell you why I look at it differently. At my meeting, the South Dixie Group, every Sunday, they have a speaker. And they generally have speakers, most of the time they have speakers that have less than 10 years. Nothing wrong with less than 10 years, but they generally have, you know, people that are relatively new. And I go to that meeting almost all the time, you know, at the 11 o'clock meeting. And I just love listening to the speakers. I don't know, these people just they like blow my mind. And I've been speaking for years, you know, and I go to conventions and stuff and everything. But I got to tell you something, I go to this meeting, and some gal with like 5 years gets up and tells a story. And I'm sitting there, I'm saying, I swear, I sit there, I'm transfixed. I said, that is the greatest story I've ever heard. And I'll say to myself, man, I wish I could have a story like that. You know what I mean? Why can't I speak like that? Because they're talking about a drunkalogue. You know, they're talking about, a lot of their story is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I remember when I first came in, somebody told me, your story will change. Your story, can you imagine? So now it's possible when I had 5 years, might have been able to have, maybe I had a good drunk log. I mean, I could do a drunk log. I could do something, sound like a drunk log. You know, they'll say, yeah, he is a fucking alcoholic. You know, I mean, I could do that, but I can't do it the way I did it when I had 5 years or 3 years, because I was closer to the booze. You understand? Mm-hmm. Because after the booze, I've been fighting. So what happens is when you first come in, what it was like, you tell your story, what it was like, that's like 25, 30 minutes. What happened is 5 minutes. What it's like now is 10 minutes. And then as you go along, so then she started, this particular person started talking about what's happening to her right now at 5 years, what she's struggling with at 5 years. And it's a horrible situation. It's horrible. It's horrible sobriety, but wonderful sobriety. The best of time, you know what I mean? She's doing great, except for this one thing, you know, that's driving her crazy, you know, and she hasn't figured it out yet. And one of the things I said to her, because I said, you know something? 10 years from now, when you tell your story, when you have 10 years, you're gonna tell a story. It's gonna be a great story. You're gonna tell them about what it was like, and then you're gonna tell what happened. You're gonna talk about this thing that you're going through right now and how you overcame it and how it's great. You know what I mean? You're gonna tell a different story. And so when I start thinking about our stories, and I realize all the stuff that I've been through in 38 years, I could, whatever I'm saying right now, I couldn't have said 2 years ago. You know, so every year my story, every month my story changes because of what I go through. You know, I'm not who I was when I had 1 year or 2 years or anything like that. So my story changes. And as my story changes, quite frankly, because, you know, listen, I drank for 15 years, but it's been 38 years since I drank. You know, what my story is now is what it was like, that's like 10 minutes. And what happened, that's like 25, maybe 30 minutes. What it's like now, that's like 30 minutes. You know, that's because what I'm mostly close to is what it's like now for me. And what it was like maybe between 20 and 30 years, you know, something like that. And the other stuff is like in the background, which is important stuff. So I think of these steps. So I start connecting the dots, and I see the steps completely differently. I see the eagle. I see what I want to major in the majors. I see what the major deal is, whether people like it or not. And I understand them now. I get it. Okay, I get it. It's not about the fourth step. It's not about the fifth step. It's not about any of that stuff. It's about your relationship with God, how important God is to you, and how much of your life revolves around God versus everything else that's going on, based upon, as opposed to the worldly clamors, as opposed to the world. You know, Bill Wilson said, talking about emotional sobriety, he said it's the next frontier. He said the real problem with alcoholics is unhealthy dependencies. Every time I'm with an alcoholic who's got a real problem, he's talking about something that he's dependent on for his happiness. He's talking about the man. He's talking about the woman. He's talking about the relationship. He's talking about the car. He's talking about the money. He's talking about being upsettable because something that he thinks he absolutely needs, you know what I mean, is leaving his life where he doesn't have it. It's all about addiction, you know. I drank alcohol because no woman or no car or no nothing ever worked quite as well as just a few drinks. But the bottom line is after the drinks went, I went right back to all the other addictions, the women, the cars, the money, and all that sort of stuff. And how do you fight that? You can stop drinking. How do you stop thinking when you're addicted to the kind of way you think? And so when you see it in that aspect and you understand that there is a reason, what it says basically in the book, it says we're on a new basis, the basis of trust and relying upon God. But how do you do that? And that's what the steps are all about. That's what the fourth step is about. That's what the fifth step is about. It's not that God isn't there. It's just we're not there. We're not. It's not God isn't there. God is everywhere. The power is there. There is a power greater than yourself that will restore you to sanity, i.e., you're fucking crazy. You're crazy. You're so crazy, you don't even know you're crazy. And even when you know you're crazy, you have no idea really how crazy you are. You may think you're crazy, but believe me, you're looking at the tip of the iceberg, you know what I mean, on that crazy. And this is all about learning how crazy you are and not trusting yourself and your own thinking, but trusting in God. And that's a hard thing to do when you're scared and you got to have control. And you got to call up your husband and say, don't friend this guy on Facebook, you know what I mean? And you got to, can you imagine living your life worrying about who your wife is friending on Facebook, you know what I mean? Or can you imagine that, you know, but it's nothing I can do. I can't even let it bother me because I have no control over her, you know. God bless her, you know. And Besides, she's got it out. She's married to me, so that would drive anybody crazy. But what happens is you look at the four steps. When you look at the steps in light of all that stuff, you understand that what the four step is about. It's about doing a tool. It's about doing a spiritual exercise which will remove the obstacle to the sunshine of the Spirit. It's an obstacle for you to allow God's power to come in so you can be transformed. And when you look at the fifth step, which has to do with confession of wrongs and everything, it's a spiritual exercise. I'm not going to tell you how to do it. I'm not a how-to guy. I used to be a how-to guy. This is how you look in the book. There's like a chart, you know, and how you do it. There's a chart, you know. Go to your sponsor. Go look and read the book. It says this is how you do the fifth step. You take your fourth step with you. You look for a closed mouth friend. Maybe a doctor or a psychiatrist will be the one. I mean, it's not rocket science, you know. But now you may say to yourself, like most alcoholics say, well, why should I do it? Why? I'm telling you why you should do it. I'm explaining to you why you should do it. Because it's going to further remove the, because your problem is there's an obstruction between you and the power. And your problem is, unless you allow this power to come in, I'll put it to you this way, you ain't going to think yourself out of it. I know you think you're going to think yourself out of this disease. I know you think you're going to read the book and you're going to get so smart that you're going to figure out, now knowing the inner workings of your mind, being nuts is impossible. No, no, no. You're nuts. And you want to something, no psychiatrist is going to unnut you. You know what I'm talking about? No medication is going to unnut you. Only God could and would if he was sought. You know, that's what it says. There is one who has all power. That one is God. Does it say there is one who has all power? Or does it say there is one who has like 90% of the power and you got 10% of the power? Now listen, this is straight A stuff. This is in my opinion. This is stuff, maybe you don't realize, maybe, I don't think we really realize what they're saying. There is one that has all power. That one is God. No human power. Listen. You can't manage your way out of it. No human power can get you out. Only God could and would if he was. I mean, I don't know whether people really get this. You know what I mean? If you really get it and you understand, most people say, well, this guy's fanatical. Yeah, I'm fanatical. I'm laughing all the way to the spiritual bank. Yeah, I am a fanatic. I am a God fanatic. That's right. You know, I mean, that's exactly what I am. And I'm so fanatical that when they ask me to do the steps, I actually talk about what works. I actually talk about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and what you have to do in the hopes that at least one person will walk out of here and say, you know, maybe that guy's got a point. So that 6 months or 6 years down the road when somebody says, you know, why is trying to think, why am I so screwed up or why is it going on? They don't have the excuse of saying, well, nobody ever told me. I never heard that in AA. I just went to those meetings, those therapy meetings, those group therapy meetings. Where they all dump their problems. Nobody ever gave me the solution, you know? Oh, there was that one guy who talked about churches. Who was the guy's name, you know? But he was crazy, you know what I mean? Yeah, I was crazy, you know? I was crazy, you're right. Crazy works, you know? You gotta get rid of the selfishness, and that's what the fifth step is about. That's what the fourth step is about. Getting rid, every step is about improving your conscious contact with God, and then you finally get the 11th step, and they come right out with it. They rip the blanket off of it. They say, improve your conscious contact with God. Improve your you mean to tell me at 38 years, after doing this for 38 years, you mean to tell me I got to improve my conscious contact with God? Yep, that's the deal. You mean I got to do more? Don't you hate it? The alcoholics hate that. He says, you know, they'll come up to me and say, I'm doing everything. You know? That's why I used to say, I'm doing everything. He'd say, well, have you done your fourth step? I said, no, just do your way. I mean, there's always more to do, you know? And we just want to think our way out of this thing. We don't want to do any more. We don't want to hang around people that are going to tell us to do any more, you know? But that's what the fifth step is all about. But never lose sight of why you're doing it. You're doing it because in the end, it takes time, and the final thing is, I'll end it here, is unfortunately, just like Moses marched the people, you know, they went from Egypt to wherever, it took them 40 years. 40 years! Two-week journey. 40 years. Because he was following God, because he was beating the shit out of them. So by the time they got the promised land, everybody was dead, except the people that was brought up in the desert. All the slave people were dead. You know what I mean? Well, that's what they do. Well, that's what we do in here. We sort of like march through this thing with this slave mentality and bondage to everything in this world, trying to hang on to our old ideas until we just get beaten and beaten and beaten and beaten. 9 years sober. When am I? When is this going to end? They took away my credit cards. 11 years sober. When is this going to stop? They're just constantly being beat down, you know, until finally we just give up the ghost and you just do a, you know, turned over life and give it all up. You know, get tired of the beatings. The beatings will cease as soon as we start, you know, doing the right thing. So thank you very much. Well, we have a chip system in this deal, right? Oh,